Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the MeetersUK.org podcast, as sponsored by Finlingo.com. I'm Andy Duncan and I'm coming to you tonight from a very cold and snowy Henley-on-Thames here in Oxfordshire, although it has all melted a bit today. Tonight, on Monday the 11th of December, I'm going to be speaking to our honorary president, Godfrey Bloom, who's coming to us from Wrestle in God's own county of Yorkshire, up there in the East Riding. Tonight we'll be talking about the incredibly shrinking phenomenon that used to be known as Brexit. Good evening, Godfrey.
Good evening, Andy.
And how are you doing on the snow front tonight?
Most of it has missed us, I'm happy to say, but it is bitterly cold and it's been bitterly cold for days. So we're just not getting the snow, but we're getting the freeze.
Yeah, well, we were lucky today. I think we got to 1 degree centigrade, so all the slush melted so we could drive around, which is good. Anyway, let's get down to business. Now, we've seen reports over the weekend that Theresa May has agreed to pay the EU £50 billion or £39 billion in other stories for Britain to get out of the EU. Why are we paying anything at all?
Well, I really don't know if I disappoint our listeners, but I haven't a clue. There is no legal requirement. There is no suggestion, I don't think, on either side that there is a legal requirement. There is a question whether there should be a moral entitlement. But as we've already put in somewhere in the region of £250 billion in net contributions, I can't really accept that there's a moral need for a contribution. I think what we need, and what I was in a debate with, as you know, a little while ago with Lord Heseltine on this very subject on the Jeremy Vine show, I said, if you go out to dinner and you have a couple of courses and a bottle of wine, et cetera, you expect to get a bill at the end of the day explaining exactly what is due, what you spent, what you've eaten, and you settle your account. Now, what we seem to have here, this rather crazy system, if you extend the analogy to a restaurant where you go in, the head waiter comes over and says, that'll be £400. And you say, can I see a menu first? No, you can't. You can't see a menu. You've got to give me £400. And then we may or might not tell you what's on the menu. And if the chef's in, and the chef may or may not cook you a meal, but I want the money up front. No sane individual would dream of doing such a thing in a restaurant or a car showroom or anything else. But we have this crazy situation where we are paying, or we have, it seems to me that we've agreed to pay, in order to be able to sit down and talk about the menu. Now, I might be able to understand this if we were a great exporter to the European Union. But of course, we all know that for every 100 units of import and export to, between Great Britain and the European Union, we send them 20 units, they send us 80 units. We are a major customer. It beggars belief that we would pay anything to be a customer. Now, I haven't started my Christmas shopping yet. I leave most of that kind of thing to the mem sub. But if I go to Fortnum and Mason to buy presents, I don't expect the dude on the door to charge me to go in. It's absolutely extraordinary, and I can't believe we've done it.
So what do you think is driving this then? What is this motivation where the British government wants to lock us into a customs union with Romania rather than having the chance of becoming the Singapore of the North, where we can trade with the world like we did for 200 years earlier and become a much, much wealthier nation? What's the motivation?
Well, the problem that we have is that if you have to go back in history and find out about the European Union and what it really originally was. Now, in the 50s, it came of a reasonably plausible idea based, if you will, on Frederick Bastiat, which was if trade crosses borders, armies don't. And that was the principle of the 1950s as a free trade area, albeit a customs union and a tariff union, as libertarians would understand it. But the original idea was not particularly unsound given the background of Europe. So the idea was free trade amongst the members of the European Union. And this was backed, of course, particularly by Charles de Gaulle, the French, who were great believers in having a confederation, basically, a confederation of trading states. No question of of pooling sovereignty or centralist or federalism, which we now hear. So the original idea was fairly sound. And of course, it's drifted away to what is now, and Lord Heseltine now over this very weekend has admitted, what is a federalist plan. And so the real colours are being run up the mast. But we all know, all Englishmen, all Brits know, that if we'd had a referendum on do you want a federal Europe, yes or no, the yes people would have gone absolutely nowhere. Nobody outside the academic world and the bureaucratic and political elite are interested in a federal Europe. And so we have been sold this European Union idea on the common market. And going back to 1975, when I voted yes, indeed, in the referendum, did we want to remain members of the common market? And we have always, this country has always seen it as a common market, not as a political dream, a political ideology, which of course it is. So we view the European Union in Great Britain completely different to the rest of Europe, but of course our political elite don't. Why are everybody getting upset about trade and they're talking about trade, which is a complete red herring? Why would the Archbishop of Canterbury or A.C. Grayling or rest of all these Muppets give a monkeys about trade? They've never been involved in trade. They've never been involved in commerce. They sneer at commerce. They sneer at trade. We're all terribly tacky, nasty people in trade. What they're actually afraid of is losing their political dream. Trade is a red herring. I spoke at Exeter University last year and I said, for goodness sake, get trade out of your mind. This argument has got nothing whatsoever to do with trade. It's a political ideal that's gone wrong.
We've also heard that the final deal is going to involve the UK following all the EU laws, old and new, accepting the legal supremacy of EU courts, letting the EU pillage our fishing grounds in perpetuity. We have to keep paying into the EU every year to stay within this agreement that Theresa May's cooking up. And also we're going to have to let people move around Europe, including the millions of migrants coming from the Middle East and North Africa, going through France and Italy and so on. What exactly was the point of Brexit?
Well, of course, it's being sabotaged, as I said it would on many a podcast and many a radio interview for the last 5 or 6 years. I don't mind this Americanism, deep state. I think it's very apposite, deep state. For example, you couldn't possibly get promoted in the civil service unless you were deeply committed to the European Union project. It just wasn't possible. So we have a civil service, a foreign office, deeply, deeply, deeply committed to the European Union project. So all the people that have the levers of power, which aren't politicians, incidentally, the real levers of power are the comedians behind closed doors at Chatham House. And believe me, I know these people. I've worked with these people. They are not going to let this one go. And so if I can take one or two, just take a few of those things in order, the regulatory realignment, well, most people voted leave because they wanted to get rid of the rules and regulations. That was a very major part of voting leave. So keeping the rules and regulations is completely against what we voted for, people who voted leave. We didn't want the rules and regulations. We wanted to get rid of them. We wanted to get rid of payments to them, which we could be better spent here at home, rather than sending it to the European Union, which is £12 million or so a year net, and a lot more the cost of compliance. So it's a very expensive club to belong to for the Brits as net contributors and have been since the very beginning. But what is really interesting, what is far more important than the money and trade, what is much more important, and this point has not been picked up, but our rather less than clever press and mainstream media, and that is the system of law. Now, what she's agreed to is to have European Union people, members of the European Union living here, are going to be subject to a different law to the indigenous population. So the European Court of Justice remains. And as Rees-Mogg said, if we are still subject to the European Court of Justice, we are not an independent nation. You cannot be an independent nation unless you make your own laws and you adjudicate your own laws. And this looks like it's going to go on for at least 8 years post-Brexit. So my calculation is 2028 will be still subject to the European Court of Justice, which means that we are not leaving the European Union until 2028. And that's a technical and legal position, which, of course, is an absolute disgrace. So if you look at this historically, let's look at a historical perspective here, which I find rather interesting as I was walking the dogs. you have to go back to this. You have to go back to canon law. You have to go back to canon law. You have to go back to the time of Henry II. This is why Henry II fell out with Thomas Becket. the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas
Becket. The troublesome priest.
And so he said, no, you can't try my clergy. They're subject to canon law, not law of the land. And of course, it's unsustainable to have two separate systems of law operating. It was unsustainable in King Henry II's time. It's unsustainable now. And let me give you another analogy on that one, which I think Dan Hannan's picked up on. And that is, if an American banker was working in London, of whom there, of course, there are many, if we agreed with the Americans that he would be subject to American law, not British law, he could claim the right to bear arms. He could walk down Mincing Lane or Cheapside with a semi-automatic rifle, and there'd be nothing the police could do about it because he's not breaking American law. You see where this is going, and nobody's thought it through, least of all poor old Doris, who really doesn't get it. But again, it comes back, how could we possibly have sent a vicar's daughter to negotiate with these mafioso in Brussels? You couldn't invent this stupidity, you really couldn't.
Now, Theresa May, you just mentioned there, and you did mention this might be a little bit of a conspiracy by somebody, but she was a Remainer before the Brexit election. And apparently her husband is one of the most staunch kind of Remainers that there is in the entire country. Now, she messed up the last general election, throwing away, what was it, a 20% lead in just a few weeks. Now she's messing up Brexit kind of in the worst possible way, coming up with the worst possible agreement. Is it a deliberate conspiracy by her, or is she just an incompetent who's cocking everything up?
I've spent most of my life, Andy, wondering whether we are the victims of a conspiracy or a cock-up, and it depends what day you get me. it's difficult for people like us to believe anybody could be so incompetent. It has to be a conspiracy. And when I went into politics, I got elected something like 13 years ago, and I spent 10 years in politics. And I was under the impression that once I became a politician, elected politician, I would be allowed behind the green baize door, and I would then be shown stuff, and I'd go, oh, my goodness me, now I understand. I understand why they do these things. And, of course, I've been behind the green baize door now, and they are just incredibly thick. There is no cunning plan. They're just incredibly stupid. But, of course, you're quite right. She was a Remainer. She campaigned rather weakly for Remain, but she was a Remainer. Her Chancellor is a staunch Remainer. Her Home Secretary is a dyed-in-the-wool Remainer, a deep, committed believer in the European Union project. Her husband, when she goes back, having had her ears battered by her 18 people in her cabinet are Remainers, when she's had her ears battered by them and the civil service, and she goes home to a gin and tonic, unlike Maggie Thatcher, who would have the sympathy of Dennis, she gets her ears bashed again by Philip May, who's a staunch Remainer. So I think she must be on the edge of some sort of nervous breakdown, or it could be a conspiracy. It's certainly, perhaps in 100 years, people will look back, historians will look back, our great-grandchildren will look back and say, God, weren't they all thick? They didn't realise they were being legged over. The whole thing has been a conspiracy. They're dead-handing it. As I say, technically and legally, we're not leaving the European Union now until 2028. That's got to smell a conspiracy somewhere along the line.
Yeah, there's lots of tendrils lying around there. I mean, von Mises defined a state as an area in which a ruler ruled over, and there was only a monopoly court system. So we're getting the EU courts overriding our courts, which is part of von Mises' definition of a state. So given that, should we just go straight to, I mean, in a perfect world, should we just go straight to a no deal now? And as, say, the Duke of Wellington might have put it, just live with the consequences?
Yes, and I think the consequences, I'd love to live with the consequences. Of course, being a libertarian keen libertarian myself, I would just simply declare the United Kingdom a free trade area in the same way as Singapore and Hong Kong, and let Johnny Foreigner go to the devil. We don't need them. We're the customer. It would be better for the consumer. And then when we've done that, we can negotiate what we want with whomsoever we want, and they will come knocking on the door. Believe me, if you're a German, you want to sell us cars. We take 18% of French wine. 18%. That's absolutely colossal. These people will crawl over broken glass naked and kiss our feet for a deal.
I'm sure they would. I just wanted to ask you a kind of side question, really. If we use Austrian time preference theory, and coming back again to the dreadful Mrs. May, with Austrian time preference theory, she is childless. So what that would say is that she has less of a view of the future. Now, do you think there's something to it, that because she's childless, she doesn't really care that much about the future? She just has a high time preference, and she just wants a nice, easy deal. So where she can go to conferences and get driven around in limousines and so on. And she's not really thinking of the future of Britain at all.
Well, I've heard that suggestion before. I'm not sure that I go along with it. I just think these people don't understand economics. They don't understand money. They don't understand ordinary people because they don't come out of their bubble. They live, these politicians and journalists who surround them and their the bureaucracy, they live in a bubble. And when I was driving, I was on the train, actually. I was coming back from York to Selby before the referendum. And I looked at house after house, back garden after back garden, as the train wound its way through. All neat little back gardens with little glass houses and little vegetable patches. And I thought to myself then, you know, I had a sort of vision. I thought, you people don't understand. You people in London don't understand this world. And it's the world I live in, and here in a village in East Yorkshire. You don't understand it. Because you all sit around your dinner party dinner table, do you think that's how the country thinks? You're making the mistake of thinking that a dinner party table, you know, as you tuck into your sun-dried tomatoes in NW1, you think the rest of the country thinks like you, and they don't. And of course, Yorkshire voted 70-30 in favour of leave. And I was in the pubs the other night and up to the rugby club. David Davis, I live in the constituency of David Davis, Howden and Halton Price. And over the weekend, they've been spitting feathers. You know, they're all saying the same thing because they think I've got the answer. They think I know things I don't know. What the hell are we spending 40 billion for when we've got no police, no nurses, we're closing A&E wings and all the rest of it? Now, as a libertarian, of course, I wouldn't spend it on public services. I'd give the 40 billion pounds back to the punters in tax relief. That's the way I'd do it. But what they can't understand in the pubs and clubs of Yorkshire, why we're paying. They don't understand any of this. They're bewildered. And I made a Twitter the other day, which got a lot of traction, a lot of retweets. And I said, look, David, I get on with David Davis reasonably well. He lives in the next village of Spaldington. Not a bad lad. I said, for goodness sake, though, think before you go out for a drink locally, because they'll hang you.
Yeah, it's probably not a good time for him to go around. Now, of course, what I think they're doing is Theresa May's not spending her own money, is she? She's spending our money. And what they're planning to do probably is just issue £40 billion of British government bond debt. And then eventually the Bank of England will print £40 billion to soak up that debt to keep the price of British bonds up. And therefore, the rest of us will have had our wealth devalued by this counterfeiting process. They will just do anything to get to a deal. Now, over the weekend, the DUP, I think, blocked a Theresa May deal, which basically gave Ulster to the EU. She basically sold Ulster down the river. And the DUP have taken a lot of flak for this from people like The Guardian and so on. But is she just going to sell the whole thing? She was prepared to sell Ulster down the river. Is she just going to sell us all down the river?
Well, it's quite amusing, really. She started off 20 billion, it went to 30 billion, then it went to 40 billion, then it went to 50 billion. And I could just imagine her saying by midnight, wanting to get back to her hotel, I'll chuck Northern Ireland in as well. Yeah, you know, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? I wish she'd chuck the Scots in, but anyway, that's by the by. I just don't understand what she's trying to do. What her goal is. I mean, it was, why did she wait to trigger Article 50? You know, why did she wait, you know, 6 months nearly before she triggered, why didn't she trigger Article 50 straight away? I just don't understand any of this. And I've never met anybody who does. And I think if they're not careful, I think the Conservative Party are going to be in opposition for a very long time. I think we could be going back to the Corn Laws here. We could be going to the Conservative Party in the wilderness for a long time. Everybody seems to feel totally betrayed.
Yeah, it's almost an indictment of the British political system, isn't it? Because we have the only alternative is Jeremy Corbyn, who's basically a Marxist. The Tory party seems to be dead from the neck up, having elected a Remainer to run the Brexit programme. So what can we do then? We don't seem to be able to rely on politicians or political parties in this country. What can we as individuals do to try to ensure that we get some kind of real Brexit?
Well, of course, as you know, I've devoted 25 years of my life to this, and a very significant, for me, not for Aaron Banks probably, but for me, quite a very considerable amount of money. And I'm sort of at the end of the line here now. I don't quite know where or what I can do. My wife has a theory. She wants me to campaign for a different box on the ballot ticket. And a formal, countable box, none of the above, which has to be registered and has to be counted.
It would win every election.
Well, indeed it would, because we've got no other method. You say, we either vote for a Marxist with a beard and looks like a Marxist, or we vote for a Marxist who looks like a vicar's daughter. I mean, it's like the old 1950s cars, isn't it? You can have any colour car you want as long as it's black. It's the same sort of system. And I think in order to vent our spleen on these politicians, these dreadful people who have no moral compass whatsoever, we could at least go down the road at the next election and vote none of the above. But would you believe a local landowner, conservative to his roots, and they've been donors, and his, you know, you can imagine, can't you, an East Riding landowner, Yorkshire, in the land of Lord Halifax, he's been a true believer. He actually thinks, his view is that we need a spell of Corbyn. We need a spell of Corbyn so that the Conservative Party can sort themselves out and turn back into a Conservative Party. I don't know the difference at the moment between New Labour and the Conservative Party. And Cameron was the same. We virtually have New Labour or Old Labour to vote for at the next election. And I think for a great country, that's a great shame. But let me add something else here, Andy, which, of course, I don't need to tell you, or probably don't need to tell any of our listeners. We do get ourselves into a knickers into a little bit of a knot here. But, of course, if you look at the ECB figures, which is the sort of geeky stuff I do for a living, being a research economist by profession, they're buying £60 billion worth of debt every month. €60 billion worth of debt every month. And they've been calling it asset back. I put this in my book, Magic of Banking, if I may give that a plug.
Oh, of course.
The Magic of Banking, which explains page by page how we're lied to and how we're being cheated. Now, Draghi, who I have examined, it's on my website on many occasions, poor old Draghi, hasn't got a clue. And I've torn him to shreds in committee about this. He's buying what he calls asset-backed bonds, you see, to keep the bond market buoyant, to keep it up, because bonds are artificially overpriced, as are most assets, thanks to quantitative easing. But of course, what he's actually buying, he buys things like BMW Finance or Mercedes Finance or whatever it is.
Yeah.
What he's buying is a bond issued on your next-door neighbor's teenage son's second-hand Beamer. That's what he's buying. And of course, he's buying junk debt. And of course, that's where we came in, is it not? In 2007 and 2008, suddenly all this debt was exposed as junk. He's buying €60 billion a month of junk debt. And the first one went under last Thursday. Now, I'm a sort of, as it were, economics engineer. Now, if you take an engineer to the sort of the Grand Coulee Dam or the Aswan Dam and see a hairline crack, it only looks like a hairline crack to the punter, but that engineer knows exactly what that means. And this bond going under last week is a hairline crack. And when the bond market collapses, as it surely must, it will collapse so quickly, Andy, it'll be unbelievable. It will happen so quickly. And the nearest historical event I can look at outside the economic sphere is the collapse of the Berlin Wall. Suddenly, we sat over the barbed wire watching each other, and all of a sudden it collapsed. And when it went so quickly, you could barely blink. And when the bond market collapses, it will collapse in under a week. And that, of course, just to continue that point, that will collapse the euro, and that will collapse the European Union.
Well, hopefully that won't hurt too many of our friends who are listening to this. Now, I just wanted to finish on one last thing. We've got the entire British civil service. We've got the BBC. We've got the entire tax-eating establishment in this country loving the big state of the EU and doing everything they possibly can to keep the Hotel California option going of us not really leaving the EU. What's your kind of prognosis, say, in 5 years' time? Where do you think we're going to be in 5 years' time with Brexit?
Well, I'm absolutely convinced. I've been saying this for some time. In fact, I made this. I gave a lecture at Cambridge University in 1995, setting out the time frame and exactly how and why and where the European common currency would collapse. And that will collapse the European Union because everybody will blame everybody else and it will end in turmoil. I cannot for the life of me see, I cannot conceive of the ECB surviving another 5 years. So in 5 years' time, we'll be looking at a completely different scenario. We won't be looking at what we're looking at now. We'll be looking at terrible shambles. We'll see Portugal ceding. We'll see Italy. Already Berlusconi is coming back in the polls, if you look at him, to actually leave the euro. We're looking at secessionists in Catalonia. We're looking at dissatisfaction in Hungary and Poland. I think the whole thing is starting to collapse. And I think the catalyst will be the collapse of the euro. And that's when I think the whole thing will fall to pieces. And what I would suspect comes of it is a sort of some sort of Hanseatic League, some sort of replacement in, of that nature, which will include Germany, Holland, Denmark, and the northern, the more profitable northern, more entrepreneurial northern nations. And of course, what we're also going to have to do, which is very unpopular at the moment with the CIA and the establishment and the Foreign Office, we are going to have to form a serious rapport with Russia because it's all happening in the East. It's the BRICS countries, it's return to hard currency, it's the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement. Europe is a parochial anachronism, which is demographically dying on its feet. The whole concept is gone. The whole thing's gone wrong, and it just won't be here in 5 years. And that's something, of course, that they don't understand. Your Herr Junckers and all these people, some of them do, because they went off to vote for Barroso, got a job at Goldman Sachs. He saw the way the wind was blowing. We've got, of course, George Osborne doing very nicely with BlackRock, my old company I used to work for, BlackRock. You've got Darling voting for JP Morgan or whatever it is. All these guys who are really at the top, ex-chancellors of the Exchequer, ex-commissioners, are waxing fat working for international investment banks. And I wouldn't mind betting, and I asked Trichet this in the chamber when he retired as president of the ECB. I said, I wonder if you'd mind me asking, Mr. President, where are your savings? Where have you put your savings? Are they in Swiss francs and gold or are in the euro? And he gave me a very, very cynical, dry look, I can tell you. I didn't need to guess. He's not stupid, as old Monsieur Trichet. No, I know where his money is. Yeah. It's not the euro.
And most of it in Luxembourg and Switzerland.
Oh, yeah.
After 70 years of welfareism and so on, it's not a surprise Europe seems to be going down the pan. And isn't it a great thing that we didn't get Tony Blair's wish of being sucked into the euro as well?
Well, of course, it's a bit of a moot point, that, really, because I wrote an article some time ago entitled Don't Blame the Euro. Everybody blames the euro rather than themselves. The trouble is we live in states are both social and corporate welfarist. There's no blaming the messenger. The euro, the demise of the euro simply blames the messenger. It doesn't matter what you use as a medium of exchange. It can be bags of salt. It can be silver coin, gold coin. It can be whatever you want it to be. It's simply a medium of exchange. But if you continue to spend more money than you actually take in, sooner or later you'll go bankrupt. And it really doesn't matter what the currency is. So I'm just wondering, if we'd actually been in the euro, the whole thing would have collapsed even earlier. But I don't think politically, I don't think anybody could have carried us into the euro. I just don't think the British people would have put up with that. And of course, if you think back to the referendum party, everybody thinks a little bit about UKIP, and UKIP did a jolly good job getting a referendum. But the reason we didn't join the euro was, of course, the referendum party under Goldsmith.
Speaking of UKIP, do you think there's anything for UKIP to do here? They seem to have said nothing in the last couple of months. Is UKIP finished?
Well, some of the UKIP members that I've known over many years are some of the nicest people, Andy, you could ever wish to meet. They're true patriots. They're really nice people, some charming people. Unfortunately, the leadership, the hierarchy, better than leadership, the hierarchy got hijacked in 2013. They dumped being radical and suddenly became politically correct. They also got the whiff of ermine. They thought there might be OBEs and knighthoods kicking around. And suddenly everybody became, you know, deathly hush. And of course, if UKIP isn't radical, it's pointless, isn't it? I mean, if UKIP tries to become mainstream, it became utterly pointless. And they don't have any artillery. It's all very well going on immigration, oh, kick everybody out, and all that sort of thing's fine, and that's good. That rah-rah kind of drum-banging is good, and it got a lot of votes, and it paved the way for a referendum. But sooner or later, you have to have somebody who can sit down and talk with Andrew Neil and the Chancellor and the Shadow Chancellor on the politics show and sound credible and sound like he knows what he's doing. And of course, I do apologise for this, but when I left, there simply wasn't anybody there. There was nobody else. There was nobody else who could do it. And all defence. I'm a graduate of the Royal College of Defence Studies, Sandhurst. I'm a lecturer at the Joint Service Staff College. Everything. Who else could sit down and destroy Fallon? I could have taken Fallon to pieces in under 5 minutes. But who else has UKIP got? Bless their cotton socks. They mean well. Heart's in the right place, but they haven't got any artillery.
Well, I can't think of anyone. The only person I can think of course, is Nigel Farage, and he seems to have disappeared to Hollywood, which is a bit sad for us. Now it's heading towards the time for me to open a very sneaky bottle of New Zealand Pinot Noir. Is there any other, before I do that, is there any other project or book that you're working on that you want everyone to know about?
Well, I've got two. One that might, obviously The Magic of Banking is the one that I'm on at the moment. Because I'm trying to flog that, because I think it's very helpful for people to have an understanding. Not so much Mises members, because they know a lot of the stuff in there already. But there are some things I think that some of the younger people in Mises might go, oh, I didn't know that. That might have been worth buying. It did very well at Durham University a few months ago. Everybody seemed to be very keen. And of course, I've got my other book, A Dinosaur's Guide to Libertarianism, which actually is a few chapters on just how they screw you. Just how the government screw you, and with some, you know, actually naming names and explaining how it actually happens. Yeah. And I think that's selling quite well in America at the moment, actually. But
pretty good.
So if anybody wants that, I shall bring that along to the conference, and I'll just bring a few copies in my case, and anybody wants one can buy one at the conference.
Oh, I'll have to get one of those, Godfrey. So do please bring one along for me.
Will
okay.
Do.
Thank you very much for your time tonight, Godfrey. It's been fantastic as usual, and hopefully I'll see you in January.
Looking forward to it very much, yeah.
We hope you enjoyed tonight's programme on the MisesUK.org podcast. To help us out, if you'd like to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or share our podcast links on Facebook and other sites, that would really help us to build up our profile and to help us spread our message. Here's our first 5-star review on iTunes from Physiocrat. This, says Physiocrat, is a great Austro-Libertarian podcast. I look forward to their future work. So thank you very much for that. That's much appreciated. Hopefully this podcast will be just the first part of our entire broadcasting empire network. If you would like us to help extend our message of freedom, property and civilization and peace, so we can move into more conferences and do more programs and more videos and so on, then we're happy to accept contributions via our donations page at misesuk.org. If it's been snowing where you are, I hope you're enjoying a bit of the white stuff, and let's hope we get a peaceful, prosperous and merry white Christmas. And remember, please enjoy your property and freedom responsibly.